I'm David Delegater. I was surprised to learn that Pete Rose and I had something in common, an admiration for a guy named John Ellis Temple. To baseball fans of a certain age, they would recognize him in as the subject of a new book, Johnny Temple, All-Star Second Baseman by William A. Cook. Cook has written 11 books on baseball history, many of which are associated with figures of the Reds organization, like Ted Klaszewski and Wade Hoyt. In their long history, the Reds have had a bevy of good second basemen, before Pete Rose and then Joe Morgan, and this era's Brandon Phillips, there was Johnny Temple. Big Red Machine of the mid-70s is a story practically shrouded in the mists of prehistory to many these days for a population that was not yet born. Why write a book on Johnny Temple, who made it to the big leagues in 1952? Well, Temple was typical of many who played the game in his era. He played hard, took it seriously, worked at his craft, and played to win. He played to support his family in a day in which players were chattel. There was no free agency, no players' union, and no agents to negotiate $100 million contracts. When his contract was purchased by the Reds from the minor league Tulsa club, he was making $550 a month. The biggest contract Temple ever signed was $40,000 a year. While Temple was no Hall of Famer, he became an all-star in both the National and American leagues. He finished with a .284 career batting average and averaged more than one hit per game played. As a Cincinnati Red, he finished with a higher on-base percentage than Barry Larkin, Tony Perez, Ken Griffey, or George Foster, among others. And although he never hit for power, there were few better clutch hitters in his era. On the other side of his game, he and shortstop Roy McMillan formed perhaps the slickest double play combination in the majors. His on-field demeanor, however, might best be described as pugnacious, taking no guff from any player, manager, coach, or owner. Perhaps the most famous moment of his career was a night game at Crosley Field, in which he slugged the official scorer, Earl Lawson, who'd given Temple an error on a ground ball that Temple felt was clearly unplayable. Lawson, a sports writer for the Cincinnati Post, and Temple were, off the field, the best of friends, but Temple would never let something that silly get in the way of his macho persona. After playing with the Reds for 8 seasons, he was traded to the Cleveland Indians. Pretty much no one understood the trade at the time, for which the Reds got a couple of bats and a bag of cleats. By then, Frank Robinson and Veda Pinson were the stars of the team, but Temple was its heart and guts. And to any kid who played the infield themselves, they lost the guy they looked to emulate. Temple went on to play for the Baltimore Orioles and the Houston Colt 45s, before briefly returning to the Reds as a coach and part-time player before ending his 13-year career at age 34, when he realized that he could no longer live up to his own expectations. In a comically predictable moment, on his last day as a major leaguer, he punched third base coach Reggie Otero in the face over a perceived slight. Things went downhill from there. Although he landed both radio and television broadcasting jobs in Houston, the opportunities dissipated. Bad real estate investments went south on Temple, and he and his family moved back to his home state of North Carolina, where he lived in a small house owned by his wife's family, and they lived on Temple's meager pension of $427 a month. It wasn't enough. Temple got involved in a ring of farm equipment thieves, and when he was caught, he took a plea deal with the state, his freedom for his testimony. When he passed away in 1994, he was making a bit more money doing baseball card shows. Johnny Temple's life reflected one of an almost Shakespearean tragic figure, a man hoist by his own petard. He couldn't seem to stop himself from one boneheaded stunt after another, all the while practicing his profession on the field at an all-star level. What really makes William A. Cook's book fascinating is its baseball fanatic obsession with detail and is a sociological study of the structure of the game in a different era. Whole games and even whole road trips are studiously recalled, and the racism that plagued the 50s and 60s is prominently considered and discussed as a sordid mark on our national pastime. Any fan of the game would recognize the country in a microcosm in Johnny Temple, All-Star Second Baseman. For Around Cincinnati, I'm David Delegater.